Okay? All right. Given that I didn't quite finish these slides yesterday, I'm going to finish them off today before moving on to the blackboard, because there's a few more effects that I would like to tell you about and give you physical intuition for. Something that I didn't mention yesterday is what's called reionization. So remember that the story was that in the early universe, the universe was completely ionized. And then as the expansion led to a cooling effect, the universe became neutral. And the story was that since then, the photons from the CMB had been traveling to us without scattering again. That's not quite true. So eventually, as the universe created more and more structure under the influence of gravitational instability, the first stars turned on, and they flooded the universe with UV photons. And that reionized the universe at late times. So the latest data says that this happened at about a redshift of 10, okay? So a redshift of 10 compared to a redshift of 1100 for last scattering. So between 1100 and 10, the universe was, as far as we know, neutral. And then it reionized. And so that's caused more rescattering. And so that's exactly the same process as in the early universe. And what Thomson scattering tends to do is to isotropize the temperature and isotropies that are around at any given time. So what that does is to erase fluctuations at a certain scale. So the effect this has on the primary CMB power spectrum is as follows. So remember, e to the minus t was the probability of no scattering back to some optical depth tau at some conformal time t. So the fraction that scattered is 1 minus e to the tau, right? Because it's a probability. So the effect on a given temperature and isotropy, remember these kind of ways of writing where we have the anisotropy of the photon perturbation plus this psi, which is the redshifting term. So this is the Sachs-Wolfe term that we discussed yesterday. So this is what scatters out of a given line of sight. And that has some anisotropy that it carries with it. And then there's also stuff that scatters into the line of sight. And that basically has the isotropic temperature of the sky, because it's coming from all over the sky, it averages out. So when you add these terms, you get a residual effect, which is that some perturbation in some direction, eta hat, sorry, n hat, it goes to e to the minus tau. And so it basically suppresses the perturbation by e to the minus tau. This is a number in our universe of the order of about 0.1, okay? So this is in the temperature. The Cl is essentially the temperature squared, so it reduces by e to the minus 2 tau, okay? So when tau is 0, this optical depth being 0, you have that curve, and as you increase it, you keep suppressing the perturbations. And that's exactly what you expect. It goes as e to the minus 2 tau. Okay? So that's one effect. And then I said yesterday that the CMB is polarized and left it at that. This is an advanced topic. This whole topic is advanced, but polarization especially is very mathematical. I don't want to go into that. I just want to give a physical idea of what's happening. So remember that the photon distribution at last scattering has a monopole, right? The monopole accounts for most of the acoustic peaks in the temperature, right? It's the Sachs-Wolfe source. And then I also mentioned that there is a dipole, and the dipole is suppressed compared to the monopole. And if you have the tight coupling approximation where the photons and baryons are completely coupled and they don't have any respective velocity differences, then that's all you get. But tight coupling doesn't actually hold completely, and there is also a quadrupole term in the temperature. And that quadrupole source, coupled with Thomson scattering, leads to a net polarization. So if an electron observer, Lars Kattering, saw an isotropic pattern around it, and that was tight coupling, that's all that was there, you don't get any net polarization. But because it sees a small quadrupole, it sees a net polarization, which is down from the temperature. And there are two types of CMB polarization, yes. I'm going to get to that, but I'm talking about linear polarization at the moment. So there are two types of CMB polarization, okay? One is an E mode, which is a curl-free mode. So it's the same as an electric mode from E&M. You must be familiar with that. Then there's the so-called B mode, which is a divergence-free or magnetic mode, okay? So this is the E mode. And if there are only scalar perturbations in the early universe, that's all you get, right? If there are tensor perturbations in the early universe, which are gravitational waves, then you would get this B mode, okay? So it's a very important point about CMB polarization. It's a second order effect sourced by this small quadrupole term. On the other hand, it's the only thing which will discriminate between scalar and tensor perturbations, okay? So tensor perturbations source scalar perturbations, but tensor perturbations the only thing that source this B mode, okay? So if you see this, there's a chance that you might have detected tensor perturbations or gravitational waves. And also because, yes, it shouldn't be obvious just because I said so, but I'm actually going to just say so now, okay? Because we have to get to some of the physics. So just remember that there is this thing called a B mode, and the definition of that, it is divergence-free, okay? And if you look at patterns on the sky of the polarization, it kind of has this handedness, right? And it's a very, very small signal. The temperature is actually correlated with the polarization, because remember I told you that the polarization is sourced by the small temperature quadrupole that comes from the breakdown of the tight coupling approximation. So you expect that the temperature should be correlated with the polarization. And it is, in fact, the case. So around, on very large scales, around cold spots on the sky, so cold spots are over or under densities. Yes, very good. And you get, on very large scales, on average, a radial pattern around the cold spots. And the hot spots, which are under densities, have a tangential pattern around them. Here's bad plot of what that would look like. Let's skip past that quickly. And okay, and then there's the signal from reionization. So this is the same plot I showed you yesterday, which is a cartoon space-time diagram. So space this way, time that way. So this is the Lars Kattering surface. And yesterday I told you a small lie, which is that after this point, the photons don't scatter. But eventually, you know, this part of the universe is neutral, but the universe reionizes here again, right? And then not only does it erase fluctuations from here on out, it also sources some polarization. And because of this projection of this closer real Lars Kattering surface, the way that that projects onto the sky is a bigger angle. So you expect that polarization should be sourced by this reionization on large angles. And okay, so you can think about it like that. If you are here, this is you, right? And this is your Lars Kattering surface, right? And this is your reionization. Right. However, to calculate the polarization, you shouldn't think about yourself. You should think about electrons along the line of sight. So imagine that here there's a free electron. That's the first time since last scattering that there was a free electron because the universe has reionized. Okay? It sees its last scattering surface here, right? And it sees its temperature quadrupole. And then it sources polarization. These are the two different components that describe the polarization, okay? So you have to add up all along each line of sight on the sky, each electron. So this electron here sees a bigger last scattering surface because the universe has expanded. And then this one sees an even bigger one. So you have to do a line of sight integral for each observer at its particular conformal time and form this integral where you can see that this d is just this distance here, and this is tau integrated over these distances, and that's the quadrupole. Okay? So I don't expect from this for you to be able to do this calculation, but just understand that to calculate the polarization in a given direction, you have to do this line of sight integral. And when you do that, then in the power spectrum, this is the temperature. So the polarization, as I mentioned, it's a smaller effect, so this is a logarithmic scale here. It's down from the temperature by a couple of orders of magnitude, and increasing tau basically produces this so-called reionization bump, okay? And the polarization is sensitive to this bump as tau squared. So that's the best way of measuring that parameter. And because the rescattering generates, the peak of the reionization projects to a scale like this, where this is a wave number, and this is the conformal time at reionization, and this is the conformal time at recombination, right? So this is roughly 2, it just happens to be the case. And that projects to a scale like this, which is just the ratio of that distance and the distance from us to last scattering. From us to reionization. So this one is from reionization to recombination. This one is from us to reionization. So that ratio is large. So therefore, you get a large angle polarization effect. So to put all of those things together, we mostly talked about these scalar perturbations, and we mostly talked about the form of this black line, which is the temperature power spectrum. So in addition, there's a temperature polarization autocorrelation power spectrum, and there's a linear polarization autocorrelation power spectrum. The tensor modes, if they exist, will also form all of these combinations, right? But tensor modes are the only thing that primordially sources this B mode autocorrelation power spectrum. You might see that there's a B here, but this is a secondary effect. Because what happens is that as the CMB photons travel from the last scattering surface to us, it passes through all the large scale structure that has since formed in the universe, and it is weakly lensed. Okay, and that weak lensing changes the E mode into a B mode. But you can see it looks quite different. So it is peaking at much smaller scales than this primordial signal. Okay, we will have more to say about this on Friday. So in preparation for the exercise you will be set for the tutorial this afternoon, I would like you to tell you a little bit about how do you extract information about cosmology from this power spectrum. Okay? So this is cosmological parameters from the cosmic microwave background. It's a very important topic because what's happened in about the last 5 to 8 years is that the CMB has been used a precisely calibrated way to extract information about cosmology from this data. So we already went through yesterday a few things about, you know, how various parameters like baryons and photon density and so on affect the physics of these acoustic oscillations. So the first thing is this projection effect. We are seeing a standard scale called the sound horizon projected onto our sky, right? So the sound horizon at Lars Scattering is projected onto our sky. And you did an exercise yesterday that related a horizon at recombination to a scale on the sky, right? In a similar calculation, you can also project the sound horizon, which depends on the matter density and the baryon density, and calculate a physical scale, see its projection, okay? So peak locations depend on this thing here. Secondly, we discussed yesterday the damping scale, and the damping scale is something we will discuss more on the blackboard later. So that's the one where, because photons diffuse a certain mean free path before they scatter again, that erases fluctuations and the CNB fluctuations are damped. This damping here at small scales. So that's sensitive to the baryon density because that's sensitive to the number of free electrons. So these things depend on the baryon density and the matter density for a fixed CMB temperature, which essentially fixes the radiation density. So this is, as you can imagine, a very well-measured parameter because it's the most perfect black body there is that we know of. So the peak heights, remember the simple harmonic oscillator analogy, depend on this baryon loading, like how many baryons, what is the density of baryons there is in the universe, and also on the gravitational potential wealth, which is mainly set by the cold dark matter, because this number is much bigger than that one, essentially. Okay? So once you specify those, the sound horizon and the damping scale are standard rulers. Like we discussed in the tutorial yesterday, you can use an angular diameter distance to extract information about the cosmological parameters. So then we are left with the geometry of the universe. Did the first lecturer tell you about open and closed universes? Okay, so that's the geometry, okay? That determines what the metric is that you're using to propagate your light rays through the cosmos. And then there's, did you mention something called dark energy? Right, so there's dark energy, and there could be neutrinos could have mass. We know almost certainly they have a very small mass. And that changes the angular diameter distance to Lars Scattering. Do you have a feel for why that would be? What goes into the Friedmann equation when you calculate angular diameter distances, or in fact, any distances? There's an h squared on the left, and there's a rho on the right, yeah? So that rho, the way that scales with A, the scale factor, depends on what component you're talking about, right? What is the equation of state? How do things redshift? So all of these things affect H, and they affect A, and they affect any distance measure you're going to calculate. So you can imagine that once you specify these things, you are able to calculate the angular diameter distance, no? Okay. So if you can calculate that, so you can see that the same parameters go into calculating this, this, and this. You measure a scale on the sky, right? And then you have a consistency between these parameters. So one of the easiest things to understand is how is the CMB sensitive to the primordial power spectrum. This is the thing where we had all those wave numbers that were coming into the very confusing horizon yesterday. Right? So what we have is some primordial power spectrum, which is just a function of wave number. And then it depends on, say, for example, this is a very good approximation for our universe, sorry, that this power spectrum as a function of k depends on something ns to, k to the ns minus 1, right? So ns is very close to 1, and a bit smaller than one in the real universe. So it's almost you know, the same power in logarithmic intervals, okay? So this thing basically makes the CLs tilt in the way that you expect. If there's more power on small scales compared to large scales, right, in terms of K, that translates into the same effect in L. So small scales, more power means at large L, there's more power. Okay? So it's very easy. So you just change the balance of the power. So there are some parameters which are degenerate in the CMB. I think I set you one exercise to try and explain one of those degeneracies. I'm not sure whether you've done it. Okay, so if you've got this angular diameter distance, this is one quantity, right? And to calculate this one quantity, you use the Friedman equation. And the Friedman equation, you sum up all the different kinds of density evolutions, right? So you can put in a whole bunch of things on the right-hand side of the Friedman equation and get an angular diameter distance. On this side, you have a bunch of things. On that side, you have one thing. So that's called a degeneracy. You can't distinguish between how you can play off against the things on the left, the right-hand side to get the thing on the left-hand side. Okay? So sometimes, in order to do this kind of distinction, you need to have external data sets. Okay, so baryon density, we went into a great deal of discussion yesterday, and there is more to come about the simple harmonic oscillator and so on, and how that's affected by having baryons, okay? So when you increase the baryon density in the universe, right, so this is what happens. Blue is small. Pink is large, and as you increase it, you increase the disparity between the odd and even peaks. Remember, we went through this calculation yesterday in a kind of hand-wavy way. We will do it more accurately. And then, so you have this monopole term. It oscillates with this midpoint, where this is, remember, the baryon to photon density ratio. And this is the scalar potential, right? And so this is the Sachs-Wolfe source, where I've just added a psi there, right? So if this oscillates with that zero point, this is, remember, the simple harmonic oscillator, then the Sachs-Wolfe source oscillates around this quantity here, okay? So if you increase the omega baryon h square, which is the baryon density, you increase the baryon to photon ratio, right? So increasing that boosts the compressional peaks, because remember, the compressional peaks are in the are boosted in the direction of the force, which is gravity, right? So adding more baryons increases the gravity, and it boosts the compressional peaks. So that's 1, 3, and so on, right? So adding more baryons should increase the first peak with respect to the second peak, and that's what we see happening here. Okay. The cold dark matter density also has an effect on the peak structure. So if you increase the amount of cold dark matter in the universe, what does that do to matter radiation equality? So you've kept the radiation the same, and you increase the amount of matter. Matter radiation equality moves which way? Right, but does it mean that it happens earlier on or later? Yeah. So when it happens earlier, remember that recombination was a bit after matter radiation equality, remember that? Okay. So there was still residual radiation density around, right, during recombination, even though matter radiation equality had happened before that. However, if you move the matter radiation equality even further back into the past, it decreases the amount of radiation density that's around. Yeah? So when that happens, what that does is, remember that Sachs-Wolfe effect, the integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect, which was controlled by if the potentials decay while the photons are traveling through them. So that effect, where the blue shift is not canceled by the red shift, remember that? So that added power at large scales, right? So that becomes less. So in that case, you should suppress the peak heights. And that's what we see happening here. So here's omega matter h squared. So blue is low and red is high. So this is the one where the matter radiation equality has moved further back into the time. There's less radiation around, less integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect, right? So there's fewer anisotropies here, and the peak height is suppressed. When you decrease it, this thing boosts up. So that's what's happening here. So the peak locations is mainly affected by the geometry of the universe or whether there's a cosmological constant. And this is, again, quite easy to understand in a qualitative way. So this omega curvature, I don't know if Niyayesh referred to it in these terms, but there's the thing called the universe being closed and the universe being open. And we think the universe is flat, which means it's basically Euclidean geometry, right? But if it was closed, what happens to angles in a closed universe? Okay, so in a flat universe, it's just Euclidean, right? The three angles add up to 180. Okay. I'm going to draw something here. You tell me which one this is. Oops, this is closed, yes. And what is this? Right. So imagine that this is your reference CMB power spectrum. When the angle is bigger like this, which way do you expect the peak to move? Remember, these are larger scales and these are smaller scales. The projection, remember the calculation you did yesterday afternoon? Right? Now this angle has increased from that calculation. So it should move this way, right? And in this case, the angle has become smaller, so it's projected onto smaller scales. It should move that way. That's exactly what this is. Okay, good. So having a cosmological constant or not makes a similar effect. So if you have a cosmological constant, yeah, it's too bad I don't have time to go into that calculation. It's a nice one. You can always show that if you have a certain amount of matter, and you add a cosmological constant on top of that, the angular diameter distance increases, always, right? So now you have the same standard ruler, because remember, cosmological constant is a recent phenomenon. It wasn't around at recombination. So the sound horizon remains the same, right? So before you had this angular diameter distance, and now you've increased it, right? And that changes this angle. Yes. Yes.
Great. So you also need to need dark matter also to explain these rotation curves with galaxies.
Mm-hmm.
So if you estimate the amount of dark matter you need to fix up all the rotation curves, mm-hmm. does that give like a better prediction for the CMB than you would have got without it?
The CMB is a very, very good baryometer. What that means is it measures omega baryon A square extremely well, right? So that makes a prediction that's better than any astrophysical measurement of how much baryons we should see in the local universe, including in galaxies, right? So once you fix that, I didn't actually tell you the constraints here. You see, this number. This is the current measurement from last year of the baryon density, right? See the number of precision figures here, okay? From astrophysical measurements, you can never get anything as close as this. For the matter, you again get about 6% measurement, right? So the galaxy data, even though it's very compelling because, you know, it's close to us, it's easy to measure, and so on, and it's, you know, the physics of galaxy rotation curves are not hard to understand, right? Whereas here we are, you know, going through all this process to extract information. So the point is that this gives an independent measurement, which is very accurate, but it's localized in time in the early universe. And then what astronomers try to do is to measure, say, in galaxies, how much localized dark matter should be, right? But this is a global measurement about the entire universe, right? It seems that if you make local measurements about dark matter, the larger and larger scales you go, the more and more dark matter you need to explain the observation. So galaxies need, say, they need this much dark matter. If you go to cluster scales, that ratio of baryons to dark matter is not enough. You need even more, and so on. And this is the ultimate number for the whole universe. Okay? It's about different scales, different redshifts, how much you are averaging over the whole universe. But it's a good question. So again, this is a good point to illustrate about cosmology and even astronomy in general. It's that we have one universe to measure. And we can't do experiments. So we have to try and piece together a story. It's like a detective work. Try to piece together a story and test it in as many different times, as many different locations as possible, and see whether the story holds together. So, right. Reionization I went through. Okay, so here's a summary of the parameter dependences of this primary CMB power spectrum, right? I'm sure this will look better on the notes that you should have been given. So now that we've got to the end of this, what we will do this afternoon in the tutorial is the last question that's been given to you guys. It's a numerical exercise in which I'm going to ask you to download a piece of code which calculates accurately all the different physics we have discussed qualitatively. And you are able to change cosmological parameters and get out a power spectrum and plot it and see whether it matches the kind of intuition that we've got here. Okay, so having said that, I will now move on to the blackboard. So, this is the baby version of the simple harmonic oscillator. Can you read my handwriting? Okay. So, Thomson scattering is the most important process. It's actually endlessly fascinating to me that such a simple physical process, which you probably learn about in undergrad, like in the first year or something, can lead to so much beautiful physics that lets us learn about the universe. So that's the main thing about Thomson scattering. It's okay. So the cross section averaged over the polarization state is this. So that's a fine structure constant, and this is the mass of the electron, is right. So the density of free electrons in a fully ionized universe is usually written x sub e equals 1, that's fully ionized, is roughly right. So the main thing to note here is that the number of free electrons is proportional to the baryon density, and it's also a function of redshift. Okay? And this is the helium fraction. This is about 0.24. And this creates a high Thomson opacity. And that's just a fancy way of saying that the electrons essentially make all the photons scatter, and there isn't that much time between free scatterings. And this opacity is the derivative of the optical depth, and it's related to the number of the number density of electrons, the Thomson scattering cross section, and the expansion rate, where this dot, as always, is conformal time. And this is the optical depth. Is there a question?
What's the
life? I said that this was the helium fraction. It's 0.24. And then this tight coupling approximation, which gives such good answers, is what we will move on to now. And so near recombination, which is about redshift of 1000, omega baryon h square is 0.02 in the universe, right? The cool moving photon mean free path is about 2.5 megaparsec. It's much bigger than the scales we are used to, but what about cosmological scales? Right, fine. So what's the scale of the Milky Way, you know, roughly
1 megaparsec.
No, much smaller than that. So it's typically the distance between galaxies is not that far off from this, right? So the Andromeda galaxy is about a megaparsec away from us, about 770 kiloparsecs. Okay. So what can I say about this then is that it's a very small scale compared to cosmological scales. Remember, what was the distance to the last scattering surface? yesterday. It's about 14 gigaparsecs, right? So this is smaller. Right, so on scales, that are much bigger than this photon mean free path, electrons are tightly coupled to photons. By the Thomson scattering, obviously. And then they're also tightly coupled to the nuclei. By Coulomb scattering, right? So therefore, the photons are tightly coupled to all the baryons. Right? This also means that bulk velocities in this approximation can be set equal for the two components. Because the photons follow the electrons, you can set their velocity perturbations to be equal. So, no photon anisotropy in baryon rest frame. It's an equal way of saying the same thing. Also means that there's no heat conduction and so on in the fluid. Okay, so to a good approximation, even though in principle you need an infinite number of moments to describe the photon distribution function, in this approximation, what do we have? So imagine you're an electron and you're seeing the photon distribution around you. You most definitely see a monopole, right? And in this approximation, the photon velocity is equal to the baryon velocity, right? And a velocity is just the same as a dipole moment. So there is a dipole. And in this approximation, there's nothing else. So you have a monopole to the photon distribution, a dipole, and then nothing else. So in this approximation, you wouldn't get any polarization. But actually, this tight coupling approximation breaks down, right? Because the photons do have a mean free path, and they do diffuse out. So you actually do get a small quadrupole as well. But we are going to ignore that. So in the zeroth order approximation, you have the momentum density of the fluid. And that's just, this is the pressure, and this is the velocity. So then this R, the baryon photon ratio that we've been talking about, can be written as Okay. Right. Remember we said these two to be equal down there? That's one. Okay. What is the pressure of baryons? Do they have any pressure? They're like a box of rocks. Right. And do you remember the equation of state for radiation? Y minus? Yes, very good. So you see where that 4/3 came from now, right? Okay. And this is part of a problem, but you can take this ratio, you can set the equation of state to be 1/3, blah, 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 you get that, right? And then this is roughly equal to 0.6 omega baryon h square over 0.02. And why I put 0.02 is because that's the observed value. And then A, 10 to the minus 3. 10 to the minus 3 because the scale factor at recombination is what? It's about 1,000, right? So that's where the minus 3 came from. This is a nice way of writing equations, by the way. You know something, you'll scale everything to that. You can figure out what happens when you change the number that you thought you knew. Okay? And then we also know, I hope, that the radiation density goes as temperature to the 4th power. Is that obvious? Okay. Well, in case it's not obvious, let me give one way of understanding it. We know the radiation density goes as A to the minus 4, right? And we know that temperatures drop as 1 over A. So the photon density, therefore, goes as temperature to the 4, right? So imagine that this thing is now fixed by measuring the CMB temperature, which is 2.73. That's the measured value. And then as a function of redshift, that's it. Right? It goes as 1 over A, so therefore it goes as 1 plus Z. And that's Kelvin. Right? So if you neglect that there's any radiation in the expansion, which, as I mentioned yesterday, is a good approximation, right? Because matter-radiation equality has happened before recombination. We care about quantities during recombination. We can just say that omega matter or omega radiation is 3.6 omega matter A square over 0.15 and A to 10 to the minus 3. So it's a different scaling here. So here it was just baryons, now it's matter density here. Right? So now what is the time? Okay, I think that it's possibly time to stop, is it? So if I were to carry on, I need to write two more pages, and that would take me well over. It's better to start with the series of equations we need tomorrow morning. All right. Are there any questions?
Sure.
Yes.
Is this an all-or-one statement that the CMB?
Sorry, what's this? This?
In the CMB, at the end of the.
It's a Kelvin.
It's a Kelvin.
Sorry, what did you think it was? Oh, a wave number. Okay. Thank you.